Well, right after watching a bumper like that, it's kind of difficult to have a talk right behind that and try to start talking because you're going, wow, that was significant. That was heavy. Wow, what Jesus went through and how he bled. And see, what we're going to do today is we're gonna spend our time focusing on we're going to remember. Because see, what Jesus did is worth being remembered, and we're gonna look at that and focus on that and see what we should do with that. And when we finish our time together today, we're gonna have participated in something some people call the Lord's Supper, others say the Last Supper, some people call it communion. It can be called any of them, but we're gonna participate in that together. And you'll know that we're at the end of our service because we will have completed that when we get to the end. And if you end up leaving before we get to that, you're gonna miss out on a very important piece of why we are gathered here today and what we're going to do to really just kind of remind ourselves and refresh ourselves of what it is that Jesus went through and why he actually went through it. Well, today we're going to talk about this idea called remembered. And I was thinking about some things that I often think about and that I can go, hey, what are these things I focus on and I reflect on through different times of my life? And then I go back and I started thinking about this memory that I think we probably can all relate to. And we probably, most of us here, remember our first kiss. That you just remember that. I know for me, I remember my first kiss. I was in New York. She was a hottie. I mean, as hot as a four-year-old could be. I mean, she was it, you know. And so I was four as well, just to be clear, you know. So just want to make sure that everybody knows, oh, that's kind of scary, you know. And so I do, I remember that was my very first kiss of having her. Her name was Christina, so I've never forgotten about Christina. And you have to fast forward a whole nother decade before I got to my second kiss. I mean, that was a long, dry spell. But I did. It took 10 years before I had my next kiss, you know. And so I learned a little bit more about kissing when I had that kiss, you know. And then you have to go from that point, you have to go another 10 years before I have my most memorable kiss of them all. And that's the kiss when I kissed for the very first time somebody who was called Cheryl Deal. And it was our wedding day, and it was after we had exchanged our vows and made this covenant commitment to one another that we ended up sharing a kiss as a husband and a wife. And I remember that. That is one of those special memories of mine. I think there's things in life that we end up remembering, that we think about. And sometimes it can just be something that happens and all of a sudden it stirs up a memory and we remember something. And most of the time when we're remembering something, that we remember the good things, the positive things, that different things trigger that. You know, we were sitting around a table with some friends that were from Houston this weekend and we started talking about some different things of memories that we've had and that we've shared over the years. And it's just good to think about those things that we want to remember. One of the things that Mark, he was doing as he was sharing with you earlier, sharing with our offering talk, is he was sharing about something that's going to be a memory for many people that went on a mission trip. In fact, we've got a photo that you can see of some of the team people that actually went on that, and that they came up, and there they are, and they're part of that team, and that deep, dark colored shirt is that team, and that they have some memories. They're going to forever remember what it meant like to go and do what they did, to give of their time, of their financial resources, so that they could share the hope of Christ with others. So today, as we think about this idea of remembered and what it is that's worth remembering, that certainly the greatest things in life are the things that are worth remembering. It's those greatest things in life that we think back on and reflect back, and we go, those are the things worth remembering. And so we're going to look at the giver of life and see what is worth remembering with him. We're going to be in two places in our Bible this morning. We're going to be in our New Testament, a book of Luke 22, and we're going to get started there. We're also going to be in a book in our Old Testament. This book of Exodus is where we're going to be, this book that follows Genesis. It's the second book in our Bible, and we're going to be looking and seeing. So as we participate today in this Lord's Supper, Last Supper, communion, again, whatever it is that you call it, I think that probably everybody in here has some kind of understanding of what that's about. But maybe you're here and you're going, you know, my understanding is very limited. I kind of know it's that thing that they just kind of do at church, and it seems like some churches do it every week, and other churches do it, you know, on a monthly basis. Some churches do it on a quarterly basis. And then you find a church like Crosspoint, it's like, hey, we're committed to doing this once a year. You know, sometimes we'll do it more, but we'll do it at least once a year. And you're going, okay, so that's that thing, you know, where they take that little bread and it's not much, you know. They call it supper, but it certainly isn't much to satisfy, you know. And then they give you a drink, and it's like, wow, that's kind of like a sip instead of a gulp. And you might not know a whole lot about that. You might be somebody that you're here that you're going, Lord's Supper, oh, I love it when we think about that. I love it when we focus on that. I love it when we take the time to remember. I love when we participate because you have more understanding and more depth of knowledge. And maybe you have a lot more emotional connection to what that is and what that means. And I hope that by the time we finish our time together, that everybody in the room is going to be able to have a greater understanding and a greater significance of why it is that we take the time when we remember Jesus, that we take the time to do it by taking this little piece of bread and taking this little sip of a drink. And we do that and we remember him. So let's get started in Luke. Chapter 22, we're going to start in verse 7. It says, now the festival of unleavened bread arrived when the Passover lamb is sacrificed. And you look at that and you might be going, yeah, see, that's why I don't read the Bible. Because it says a bunch of things. Like, Mama, I don't even know what it's saying. I'm just confused. I'm lost. And so you might look at something like that and go, that's why. Well, let's make sure that we understand. Let me read this next verse and we'll understand it together. It says, Jesus sent Peter and John ahead and said, go and prepare the Passover meal so we can eat it together. That this festival of unleavened bread, this festival that they do every year, it's when they celebrate the Passover. You and I would probably just refer to it as the Passover, but people that are Jewish and follow Jewish culture and traditions, they're going, no, that's the Feast of Unleavened Bread is what we're doing, and inside of that, we remember the Passover. And some of you, you're going, oh, yeah, I remember what the Passover is, and others of you are going, I'm not really sure what is that Passover? I mean, they had bridges back then, and, you know, what did they do? How did you get over, you know? So the Passover is something that we're going to begin to understand. I'm going to unpack it a little bit before I give it away and share with you guys exactly what this is and why it was called this. But see, Jesus has taken his disciples. He's already been sharing with them and preparing them that the time has come. And this time of great suffering and sacrifice is going to happen. And this is his one final time of him to remind them of this. Before he goes and he gives his life. And he does. He willingly gives his life. His life wasn't taken from him. Make no mistake. At any moment, he could have stopped it. Yeah, it's kind of power and authority that Jesus had. But he willingly laid down his life and he gave it. So he tells his disciples to do this because this is something that is, it's a feast and it's a celebration. It's something that they do annually. And they've been doing it at this point for about 1,600 years. And they've not forgotten about this. And the Jewish people keep doing this. So to understand this more, we're going to go to the book of Exodus and see the setup for it and then understand what it is. So the Israelites or Hebrews or Jewish people, any of the three, you can refer to them that way and understand who we're talking about. They're in Egypt. And they've been in Egypt for 430 years. And 400 of those years, they've been captive. They've been slaves. They've been underneath the crushing thumb of the Egyptians. And so there they are, and they're going, hey, what's going on? Why are we here? Because we thought God had promised us that we were going to get our own land, and we were going to rule over that land. It was going to be the best land ever, and here we are. And they're stuck. But God had singled out Moses. Singled out this guy, and maybe you've heard of this guy, Moses, and he's the one that has been responsible for bringing in the Ten Commandments. He hasn't even done it at this particular point in time. God hasn't revealed it to him, so he hasn't shared it with the people yet. This is him getting started on his journey that 40 years earlier, God had singled him out at this event, this burning bush event, and God singled him out and said, hey, I want to use you, and I want you to lead my people, and he was really hesitant and really didn't want to, but God led him to believe and see that was something that he needed to do. And so we get to see now that now he is coming in, and now he's 80 years old, and now he's going to come in, and he's going to free, and he's going to lead God's people out. So we're going to jump back into our Old Testament, get a little more context of this thing called the Passover, where it came from, why it's even remembered as that, and what's going on. So Exodus chapter 5, starting in verse 1. says, Moses and Aaron, now Aaron was his brother, because Moses, when he was being approached by God and God said, hey, I want to use you to set my people out, he's going, I can't do that, God, because I have this speech. In fact, I get real nervous in front of people and I can't get it out. And he did. He had this speech impediment. And so he's going, you can't use me. I can't do that, God. So finally God says, okay, well, just take your brother Aaron and you can just tell him and then he'll be the spokesman to the people. And so that's what they've been doing. And so now we get to see Moses and Aaron. They went and spoke to Pharaoh. Pharaoh was the king of Egypt. And they told him, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival in my honor in the wilderness. So this is God, and God's going in and God's saying it. And Moses, he knows Pharaoh because for a season of his life, Pharaoh was like grandpa to him. Because he was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and so he was known him, but now he's back. It's been 40 years since he's been there, and now he's back, and he's coming, and he's sharing this message. And so Pharaoh, we get to see this verse 2. Is that so, retorted Pharaoh? And who is the Lord, and why should I listen to him and let Israel go? I don't know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. He's like, why would I let you guys go? You guys are cheap labor. I mean, you guys are our slaves. And so I'm not going to set you free. I'm not going to let you go. And at this point, it was a request for a 3-day excursion. You know, I'm not willing to give you guys up for 3 days. In fact, what Pharaoh ends up doing at this request, he ends up telling the leaders that lead over the slaves. He says, stop gathering straw for them as they make their bricks. You make them now go gather their own straw. We're not going to gather the straw for them anymore. So they didn't mind gathering straw. It was an easy task, easy chore, but it did take time. So now they're going to have to go do this. But make sure their production rates stay the same. So now they were having to work even harder, and they began to complain, and they began to regret that Moses had done this and went and sought to set them free. Like, I guess it really wasn't that bad before, and now it's a whole lot worse. So Moses is feeling this pressure from the people, and so he goes back and he spends time alone with God and just praying to God and saying, God, why did you send me in there to ask for Pharaoh to let your people go when he's not going to let him go? And now the Israelites, they're all mad at me and they're mad at you, and this just isn't good, God. So let's see how God responds to that. Exodus chapter 6, starting in verse 1. It says, then the Lord told Moses, he says, now you will see what I do to Pharaoh. When he feels the force of my strong hand, he will let the people go. In fact, he will force them to leave his land. God said, by the time I'm done, he's going to be the one telling you to go. And God said to Moses, I am Yahweh, the Lord. He's already revealed this to him before. That's his name. Yahweh means I am. So he's saying, I am the I am. That's who I am. That is my essence. That is my name. That is how you know me. Verse 3, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob as El Shaddai, which means God Almighty. But I did not reveal my name, Yahweh, to them. These were men that came way before Moses' time. And Abraham was the founding father of the Israelite nation, that God singled him out. Verse 4 says, And I reaffirm my covenant with them. Under its terms, I promised to give them the land of Canaan, where they were living as foreigners. You can be sure that I have heard the groans of the people of Israel, who are now slaves to the Egyptians, and I am well aware of my covenant with them. That some of them are thinking, you know, he's forgotten about us, he doesn't even remember. No, I am well aware. And now is going to be the time. Verse 6, therefore, say to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will free you from your oppression and will rescue you from your slavery in Egypt. I will redeem you with a powerful arm and great acts of judgment. Tell them this before it ever takes place so that they know, look at those acts. This is how we're getting free. So that they know, so that they don't look back at it and they go, what a coinky-dinky. You know what? We spent all these years as slaves, and now all of a sudden we're free. Wow, that's just amazing. No, he's laying all of this out so that they would know. Listen, these are going to, great acts of judgment are going to come, and then I am going to set you free. Verse 7, I will claim you as my own people, and I will be your God. And then you will know that I am the Lord, your God, who freed you from your oppression in Egypt. I will bring you into the land I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as your very own possession. I am the Lord. So he goes and he delivers and he tries to encourage the people, and but the people had nothing of it. They didn't want that encouragement. They refused to listen to what Moses was saying, and they weren't interested in what God was going to do because they felt like God just did not care about them anymore. But the Lord told Moses, go back to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. And so he does. But God also told him, he's going to resist. And I'm going to harden his heart, but I'm going to give you the authority. And he eventually is not just going to let you go. He's going to command you to go. He's going to force you to go. He's going to pay you to go. Well, Moses has always been a little skittish at this point of going, I just don't know God, and I don't know. And so God told him, he said, take that staff and just put it on the ground. And he put that staff on the ground and it turned into a snake. God said, now reach down there and pick it up by its tail. And he did, and it turned right back into his staff. He says, listen, I'm going to be with you. So he goes and he delivers this message to Pharaoh. And he just demonstrates the power of God by doing this. But then the Pharaoh had some sorcerers and some magicians. And they said, we can do that too. And so they did something similar and that turned the snake. But Moses' snake ended up eating and devouring all of their snakes. And he picked it back up and it became a rod again. You see, Pharaoh just wasn't that impressed still. He's telling him, let my people go. If you don't let my people go, listen, God's going to do something against you. You really, it's in your best interest. Just let them go. And he refused. And so what happens from here is you see these 10 plagues. And some of you guys are going, oh, the 10 plagues. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that there's these plagues. Oops, there's these plagues that end up taking place, and there's these plagues. And I remember that God doing this big thing. I don't remember what all the plagues are, but I remember. Well, here's where the plagues started. They started with this plague of blood. And they took this body of water called the Nile, and he took and he just held a staff over it and commanded it, and it turned to blood. It was rancid, and the fish were dying inside of there. And then they allowed it to come back, and Pharaoh was a little intimidated, and he was like going, wow, that's your God, maybe your God is power. But he looks and he turns to his magicians and his sorcerers and says, what can you guys do? Well, we can do that. And they did, and they replicated it. Oh, okay. No, I'm not concerned about your God. Well, the second plague, where he goes back in, he says, Pharaoh, you just need to let God's people go. I'm telling you, you need to let him go. If you don't let him go, he's going to send these frogs all over the land. They're going to be everywhere. It's going to be a mess. And you just need to let his people go. He goes, I'm not letting you go. And so then the frogs came, and there were frogs everywhere, and they couldn't stand it. And then the time came for the frogs to go, and just to show, yes, here's the power of God. So Pharaoh again turned to his sorcerers, his magicians, and they replicated it. And they started producing frogs, and they're like, hey, we can do that. But see, those are the only two that they were able to replicate. They weren't able to do any of the others. So Moses goes back again and says, you need to let God's people go. Let my people go. He refused. He says, if you don't let them go, then there's going to be gnats everywhere. I mean, who gets annoyed with just one gnat? That's all of us. We're like, I can't stand a gnat. But wait a second, there's going to be gnats everywhere all over the... And that's exactly what happens. And they couldn't replicate it, and I'm not sure they really wanted to either. It went from there to let my people go, and they wouldn't be set free. Pharaoh refused. And so then what took place next was we were introduced to the Lord of the Flies. Yeah, the Lord of the Flies. And he brought in flies, and the flies were everywhere. Pharaoh still refused to let the people go. So Moses left, came back again. God keeps giving him a pep talk. Go to the people. Tell them what they need to do. Go to Pharaoh. Tell them what to do. And if he doesn't respond, then I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. And so he does this again. And this time he goes with a message to let my people go. And if you don't, then your livestock, they're going to begin to be diseased. All the livestock of the Egyptians. But But God's going to protect the livestock of the Israelites just to show that this is really God doing all of this. I'm not letting you go. So some of their livestock just began to get diseased and fall dead. And God did what God said he was going to do with this livestock. After that, there were boils, these sores that just came all over everybody. After the boils and Pharaoh wouldn't move, his heart was hardened. God said, I'm going to harden his heart because we're going to make this thing so significant, so memorable that you are going to remember the Lord your God. And so from there came hail. And the hail came down, and the hail did some destruction and destroying property. But Pharaoh still wouldn't let God's people go. That God ended up saying through Moses, tell him this, listen, I could have destroyed you guys with this hail. But God decided, hail no, I'm going to let you guys live a little longer. But I'm going to let you guys live, and you guys are going to live, and you guys are going to survive, because I'm going to show my muscle, I'm going to show my strength, I'm going to flex, and you're going to know exactly who the Lord God Almighty is. So the hail came, and they still didn't let the people go. The next of the plagues was locusts. And the locusts came in, and in the city where all the Israelites would stay at night and camp out at night, the locusts didn't come there. But everywhere else around the main cities of Egypt, the locusts came in, and they just destroyed and ravaged everything that was a living plant. Just destroyed it. Pharaoh still would not let God's people go. There was two plagues left. One was this plague of darkness. And it wasn't something that they're like petrified over and go, oh, now you got to go. And God did this darkness thing. But then it was this tenth one. And the tenth one was the one that was, it would be forever remembered. And the tenth plague is a plague of death. And death specifically to the firstborn males. And so with this, God gave some instruction to the people. And this is where we begin to understand what the Passover actually is. Let me share some of this with you in Exodus chapter 12, starting in verse 11. It says, these are your instructions for eating this meal, because it was a Passover meal. Be fully dressed, wear your sandals, carry your walking stick in your hand. Eat the meal with urgency, for this is the Lord's Passover. And they're still like going, Passover? What's Passover? On that night, I will pass through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn son and firstborn male animal in the land of Egypt. And I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt, for I am the Lord. Okay, so you're going to do that, but how's that the Passover? Verse 13. But when the blood on your doorpost will serve as a sign, marking the houses where you are staying, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. This plague of death will not touch you when I strike the land of Egypt. There's other instruction that we're just not going to take time to read, but you can certainly read through that. Exodus 5 through 12 really just unpacks this whole thing about what the Passover is. But the instruction was that when you were to take this one-year-old male lamb or goat, and you're to sacrifice it, and you're to take its blood, and as you drain its blood, put it in a bin, and then you're going to take some branches, hyssop branches, and you're going to paint those with the blood of that sacrifice over the doorposts. And then you're going to take the animal, and you're going to cook it. And as you cook it, and there are special instructions how to cook, how not to cook, you're going to cook this thing. And then you're going to eat all of its meat. And anything that you don't eat, then you're going to put into the fire, and it's going to burn all the way up. We're going to consume it all. But as I come through the night with my angel of death, as I come through any house that has that blood over their doorposts, that is a house that I will pass over. I will not put the plague of death on that house. I will pass over it. And I'm going to go all throughout Egypt. And Pharaoh and the rest of the Egyptians all woke up to blood-curdling cries. Because every Egyptian experienced loss when they woke up. Every household experienced loss. Some didn't have a firstborn male son, but they had their firstborn males of their livestock, but most of them had sons. And Pharaoh had his firstborn son. And his son was dead. And with this, Pharaoh told Moses, take these 600 men and leave, flee, be done. Women and children, take them too. And God had already told Moses to tell the Israelites that you need to ask for jewelry, gold and silver, and ask for linens and clothes. And they did, and the people were literally throwing it at them. Just go, leave. We don't want anything to do. We don't want the curse of your God. And so they left, and they were freed. But God gave the instruction that because of this, this is so memorable. This was the very first feast that they were ever told. This is something you're going to do every year, annually. You're going to remember this. And so they do, and they've been doing this now for 1,400 years plus, 1,600 years plus. They've been doing this. And Jesus, he's telling his disciples, go and prepare the Passover meal. This meal that is a meal that is forever remembered as the powerful God and the one who rescues. And how did he rescue? He rescued God's people through a sacrificial blood. That's what he used to rescue them. And so he tells his disciples to go and prepare. We're going to pick this back up in Luke 22 where we left off. Where do you want us to prepare it? They asked him. And he replied, as soon as you enter Jerusalem, a man carrying a pitcher of water will meet you. Follow him at the house that he enters. Say to the owner, the teacher, capital T, is referring to Jesus, rabbi, teacher. The teacher asks, where is the guest room where I can eat the Passover meal with my disciples? He will take you upstairs to a large room that is already set up. And that is where you should prepare our meal. He's orchestrated everything. It's all prepared. It's all set. It is all ready. And for them, this isn't an empty ritual. This is something that they do. Then they take their hearts and their minds and they focus and they remember how God delivered, how God provided. And Jesus knows that God's getting ready to take this to a whole new level. And it's going to need to be remembered. And the greatest one sacrificed his life. The greatest one sacrificed his life. And what he did is worthy of being remembered. That what Jesus did for us, it's worthy of being remembered. And so Jesus gives them some instruction as they arrive and they get there and what they need to do to remember. Verse 13. When they went off to the city and found everything just as Jesus had said, they prepared the Passover meal there. And when the time came, Jesus and the apostles, those were the 12 that he had, the apostles sat down together at the table. And Jesus said, I have been very eager to eat this Passover meal with you before my suffering begins. He's been eager. Because see, Jesus is ready and he's eager to fulfill the purpose for which he came. Purpose of doing something, being a sacrifice to be able to redeem humanity. One soul at a time for anybody who would put their faith, their hope, their trust in him. Verse 16, for I tell you now, I won't eat this meal again until its meaning is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. That what it means is this Passover meal and this blood being put over doorways so that the angel of death would pass over and spare the lives of God's people. And Jesus, I'm not going to eat this meal again until this meal its purpose, its ultimate purpose, is going to be fulfilled. And so he tells them some specific things. Verse 17 says, then he took a cup of wine and he gave thanks to God for it. And then he said, take this and share it among yourselves. For I will not drink wine again until the kingdom of God has come. I'm not going to drink wine again until this major purpose of God changing things once and for all time. I won't do this. I won't drink like this again until that time. Verse 19. He took some bread and he gave thanks to God for it. And then he broke it in pieces and he gave it to the disciples saying, this is my body, which is given for you. Not taken, but given. Which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. The disciples, when they heard this, they had no idea, no understanding, no comprehension for what Jesus was really getting at. But as they remembered these words later, they certainly could see this great, great significance. So I don't think that Jesus literally meant that this bread is now my body and you're literally eating my flesh. I think what Jesus meant was there's something so symbolic and significant here I want you to see. But he had taken that bread and he had broken it into pieces. This is my body. My body that's going to be broken for you. And yes, Jesus' body was broken. He was arrested. He was taken and put on what was called these mock trials because they were all rigged. Everything was set. They knew exactly what they wanted to get as an outcome. And then they began to break Jesus' body. They plucked out his beard. They punched on him. They gave him a crown, but it was a crown of thorns, and they mushed it onto his head as it began to pierce him, breaking his body. They beat him. And as they beat him, that the Romans had perfected beating their prisoners. They had perfected it to the point where the 40th lash with this cat of nine tails would kill whoever it is that they hit. And this cat of nine tails, this big old whip that had all these long strands, leather strands, at the end of those strands, they had tied onto that pieces of metal that was sharp and broken clay and glass. And they tied that onto the ends. And they would take and they would whip. And as they would whip, they'd let that wrap around a body. And then right as it was getting ready to hit that body with those end pieces, they would pull it so that it would set into the skin. And then they would jerk it back and literally rip flesh off the body. But Jesus wasn't to be beaten to death. He was to be crucified. So they beat him with what they referred to as 39 or 40 minus 1 lashes. One hit, one stroke away from death. And then he was made to carry his own crossbeam until he couldn't carry it anymore. And then they nailed him, not just tied him, nailed him to that crossbeam. And then they rose up that cross and it dropped into the hole, jarring his body. That's been broken for you and for me. And that's what he was sharing. He wanted them to know. And I want you to remember. Remember me and remember my body being broken for me, for you. Verse 20. After supper, he took another cup of wine and he said, this cup is the new covenant between God and his people, an agreement confirmed with my blood. which is poured out as a sacrifice for you. That my blood is going to be spilled and poured out. My blood is being given because life blood is the only thing that can pay for and cover sin. And that's what I'm getting ready to go through and do for you. But I want you to remember. To remember what I have done for you. See, for the disciples, it was something that they referred to and thought about in that moment, you know, when Jesus had died. That was it. That was the Last Supper. That was it. The Last Supper. But for you and I, there's something else that we could understand this for. And that is that this was the Life Supper. Yes, Jesus is giving his life, but he's giving his life so that you and I could have life. In communion, when we share in this, it's not a time to just be sad and solemn. It's also a time to reflect on the great victory of Jesus having risen from the dead and doing what he said that he would do and redeeming us. So we aren't worthy of Jesus' sacrifice. But Jesus determined we are worth redeeming. We're not worthy of it. But yet Jesus determined that we are worth redeeming. Humanity, his most prized creation.